You're listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 526. My name is Adam White, recording for you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on tonight's show, out of, I don't know where you escaped to, Hallie, Florida? Are you still in Florida?
I'm in Florida. I feel like this whole year that we've been, like, this whole last, like, 10 months that I've been talking to you guys, you're always like, Hallie, where are you? And I'm like, oh, I'm in this random place. Yeah, it's been a wild time. But yes, I've escaped to Florida now.
This is a silly question, but is there free movement between the states at the moment? Like, can you go wherever you want?
Yeah. I mean, we drove. We just drove. No one stopped us from driving. There's no, yeah, I don't think there's any restrictions about going between states. They have rules about how you're supposed to quarantine once you do that, especially if you're coming from certain states where maybe pandemic numbers are high, but it's like you kind of have to look that up online, and then just it's on our system whether you do it or not, you know?
So that's why it's going so well. And then
exactly.
Yeah, because I think we have certain restrictions up here. Like, we can't go, I definitely can't go to like the Atlantic provinces right now. For a little while there was this thing where it was called like the Atlantic bubble, where if you were in like Nova Scotia, you could go to Prince Edward Island or one of these places, but you couldn't go get into there from outside. And I mean, I don't know how they were enforcing this. I don't think there was like armed guards standing at the provincial borders or anything like that, but they did really well and they all got to do really well together, and we were jealous of them. Speaking of being jealous, I'm jealous of John Gentile because, you know, he's living the lifestyle.
Buy, sell, hold, hold, dumping the gold, buy, sell, short change, sell, buy, dumping the platinum, Adam.
There are certain careers to which you would be a natural for, and it's a shame that you didn't go there.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you know what's weirded me out? Like, this is, I don't know if you two have seen this trend or not, but like I've extremely seen this trend over the past like 6 weeks, is like Uber punks and like super punks and like punker than nows, like they're all acting like I don't even mean this like in a silly manner. I mean this in a literal manner. Like they all are now like independent, or they're all portraying themselves as independent stockbrokers. Or investors, and they're like, I really got great gains today. You really need to watch the C&D index. You know, everyone else is chasing, you know, easy, quick grab, but I'm not a blue chip kind of guy, but I watch my gains through cryptocurrency. And I'm like, all these like Uber punks are like talking like they're big, like they're like Silicon Valley, you know, invest hotshot dude. Have you guys seen this, or is it just me? Am I insane?
You're insane.
I've not seen that. It does make me It does make me think of the GameStop thing, though, that's happening right now.
Yeah.
I feel like that's very much like a punk thing that's happening, where these guys are just like trying to take down Wall Street. Wait, Adam, what were you going to say?
No, I was like, there's a problem with these, with this whole era. I mean, like, I as much as anyone enjoy, I mean, and this is going to be weird for people who have, I guess, listened to this show in a few days after we actually record it, because maybe this whole GameStop thing is like super old news at that point and no one cares anymore. But the problem with being like militant is not the right word. The problem with being just like aggressively against the man on the subject of finances means, yeah, you can be on this like let's fuck with hedge funds thing that's happening right now, which again is super delightful, but there's only like a small walk from there to being like a cryptocurrency weirdo. And I mean, I unfortunately, because I work in tech, like I know a few, and it's a strange personality type. And you can go from like, there is only a very, very thin line between cryptocurrency weirdo to, you know, a cabal of Jews is controlling global finance. like there's a thin line between those two points of view, where all of a sudden you go from you get into this, like, you know, alternate currency mindset where you're approaching it from the, you know, hey, this is it's mathematically pure, and because it can't be fucked with because of the algorithms involved, it's free of the influence of central banks and all this stuff. And then as soon as you start like railing against central banks, then you start getting into this your YouTube recommendations are going to start giving you some weirder shit, where suddenly you're into all these theories about, you know, globalism and this and that, where you get into some icky territory there. So you got to be careful. Like, fuck with hedge funds is cool, and you know, let's say you have a academic interest in crypto, like, that's okay, but watch yourself, listener. There be dragons the further you go down this road. I'm not trying to bum anyone out, but like, fucking Nazis around every corner, man. You got to be careful.
Man, 2021 is weird. Listen, you can always reset podcasts at Punk News, but before we do that, Fleetwood Mac. I was saying, you know, I love Nick, but I can't stand Fleetwood Mac. And Hannah says, John, you should listen to Fleetwood Mac again. Listen to Tusk. And I did. And listen, people. I remember like 7 or 8 years ago, like when like people were really getting to Fleetwood Mac again, like people were like, oh, Fleetwood. Like I was talking to some dude, he's like, oh, I saw Fleetwood Mac. It was amazing. I'm like, really, dude, Fleetwood Mac? Like, anyways, Fleetwood Mac is cool. I dig Stevie Nicks. I really dig Stevie Nicks. I really dig Christy McVie. Honestly, I found out what it is what I can't say about Fleetwood Mac is Mick Fleetwood and Lindsey Buckingham. Like I can't stand like their corny 70s. Post hippie, pre new wave punk, like easygoing. I can't stand them. The cool thing about Stevie Nicks and Christy McVie, Stevie Nicks is kind of like the earnest, open, vulnerable, natural singer. Whereas, I think Christy McVie probably should get a little bit more props than she does, is Christy McVie is an extremely powerful singer. The difference between her and Stevie Nicks, in my opinion, is where Stevie Nicks is kind of like earnest and vulnerable, like Christy McVie sounds a little bit more trained, if you will. So on one side, you get the raw, honest emotion. On the other, you get technique at its finest. And they're both great singers, you know. And so when they're singing, I'm like, oh, yeah, this is great. But then when I hear, like, you know, Monday morning, blah, blah, blah. It's like, shut up, dude. Like I don't want to hear some hippie dude with a beard talking about Monday morning. You know what I mean? Like, I don't care about his problem. I really don't. And then people are like, oh, well, if you really want Fleetwood Mac, you should listen to the early Fleetwood Mac, Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac. And so I'm listening to Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac, and people are like, yeah, that's where the real music's at. Even Judas Priest covered them. And it's true, Judas Priest did cover Green Man Alicia. That song is awesome. But I'm listening to it, I'm like, you know, this is just generic, like, blues rock. Like, if I want to listen to blues, I'm going to listen to the blues, not generic blues rock. You know, or if I'm really going to listen to blues-inspired music, I'm going to listen to the Rolling Stones, the best at it, or Danzig or something like that, you know? So, end of story. I'm Fleetwood and Mac, I'm not into. Christy McVie and Stevie Nicks, I'll take them. That's my verdict.
I love that. Well, also, Lindsey Buckingham turned out to be like kind of a tool. And like, I think like, you know, even like his own band members just absolutely refuse to tour with him. And he's turned into like a bit of a joke. So I think it's funny that you just reject him musically from like the whole canon. But yeah, I don't know. I'm impressed that you, like, lots of people are like, oh, I think I don't like that thing, but if you tell me to go back and check it out, I will. And very few people actually do that. So I'm like impressed that you actually like took the time.
Well, I am a cultured person, Hallie. Will you? You know? No, see what it is. It's like whenever someone like really, really disses on something over and over and over, they probably secretly dig it. And I always like, actually, yeah, I always like Stevie Nicks. I think she's a great songwriter. So the fact that I like Stevie Nicks, there's the entry point, you know, but I just can't get past Mick Fleetwood and Lindsey Buckingham's like corny, like, 70s dude vocals. I just can't do it. I can't do it.
I mean, you have to remember what our main beef on this show with Fleetwood Mac has been, which is that they've just been soaking up all the vinyl repressing,
I approve of that. I approve of that because my argument is that if if Fleetwood Mac sells so many vinyl records, that's what keeps the pressing plants open. And that's great because, you know, the pressing plants are not making millions of dollars off pressing 300 lotion LPs, you know. They're not making millions of dollars pressing 2,000 Dwarves vinyl LPs. It's the 500,000 Fleetwood Macs and Beatles. And so if I got to wait 3 months to get my Dwarves record or I don't get a Dwarves record at all, I'm going to wait and I will let Stevie Nicks carry the burden. That's my argument.
This is far more diplomatic a position on things than you've ever taken before.
I was going to say, it's like very generous, a very generous opinion.
I'm a new man, people. I'm a new man. It's a new year. I'm a new man. You can always use that podcast at punknews.org. We love getting your mail. And we got some good mail this week. This is from Derek. Derek says, how do you balance I think Derek's written in before. How do you balance representing local bands versus touring bands? And that touring bands aren't touring right now. Do you do one and one? Do you ignore local bands? Adam focuses on local bands, but Hallie, John, and M just seem to play whatever they feel like. Don't they have some obligation to focus on bands from their area that haven't broken through? Isn't that the point of DIY punk rock? If I wanted to learn about bands that are already famous, that's already in the mainstream. It's hard enough to break through, and it's harder when local bands can't even get coverage in DIY areas. From Derek.
Yeah, I mean, the big part of what motivates me with what I've been doing on that front is, well, I mean, it's two things. The one is that, like, I was, when I started doing all the, like, really super hyper local music writing that I was doing, I was really looking at what I could bring to the table. Like, how am I useful? What kind of niche can I fill that, you know, that the rest of the world isn't currently playing with? So for me, it was kind of a nice fit because I could go and say, you know, given the sort of limited resources that I have for doing music writing as a hobby, here is an area where I could have an impact and do something where I didn't see a lot of movement happening. So, I mean, a big part of it for me with why I support local stuff in the way that I do is just because it fits a lot for me. Like it fits my available time. It seems like I'm helping, and that makes me feel good because I'm certainly not making any money doing what I do. So it ticks those boxes for me. And I mean, and I guess I just sort of mentioned what the second point there was, and that was I'm a little bit lost when I look at like music as a whole when I look at music as a whole and say to myself like how do I go and like represent, you know, the culture, like at the wider culture, like everything that's going on, I always get paralyzed. Like there's no way that I have the time to do it. And there's certain people that do, and you know, I'm amazed that they can do it, where, you know, I'll go look at certain music writers on Twitter where like they have an opinion on, you know, everything that's happening in the pop mainstream, regardless of genre. At the same point, they've got an opinion on, you know, all the hip shit that your Pitchforks are writing about. And they're also championing local stuff. Like they're not like strictly just, you know, writing about, you know, Radiohead or something like that, right? They're involved in everything. And I'm amazed that people have like the breadth of not just knowledge, but like of time that they can do that. But I can't fucking do that. And I always feel like I'm drowning when I'm trying to like, you know, take in anything and everything in music and become some sort of like uber cultural commentator. It just does not work for me. Works for John. Doesn't work for me.
I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, it's been a weird time, right? Like, you know, I can't go to shows. So like the way that I would normally like know about smaller local bands would be that I'm going to shows and I'm seeing them open for my friends' bands, or I'm seeing them open for touring bands that I like, you know. So it's my access to music and what's new and what's happening right now is just like, it's just what's in my feed. It's what friends are listening. telling me to listen to. There's no, like, because there's no shows, there's no like local scene for me to be like getting out there and checking out. And but it's such an interesting point. And I wonder like if I would be playing more like of stuff that's local to me, if I could go out to shows right now. I think that I would. But you know, but I also, not to be defensive, it's like it's a perfectly valid point, but like I've played like Weird Skin and Grim Streaker and lots of like little weird New York bands that are you know, honestly just like friends of mine. And the other stuff that I play is I like playing what I like. But I think it's a really interesting point. John, what's your reaction?
My reaction is I think it's good to mix it up. I don't necessarily think there's a lot of value in playing a band that you think is mediocre just because they're local. I think the key is if there's a really cool band that is local and not that many people know about, and if you're going to play that or a more well-known band, then maybe play the underground band. But sometimes sometimes the legends just come along and just rip your head off. Jello's album ripped my head off. Jesse Michaels' last EP ripped my head off. I'm not going to play it because I'm not going to not play it just because they're well known. I mean, I believe saluting excellence in all its forms. So I don't know. I guess I don't know if I would look at it in a mathematical ratio, but you know, just keep the mix alive. I'm a big fan of keeping a mix. You know, some popular stuff, some not popular stuff. Mix it up. Keep it mixed. That's what I'm saying.
Do you feel the need? And I've always felt this for as long as I've been involved in music stuff, but do you feel the need to like rush out and learn about something because the rest of the music world is talking about it and you realize that like, oh, holy shit, like I'm totally behind on this. Like, do you have that sense of anxiety about consuming things? Because like, so here, I mean, here's an example. I'm going to blank on his name right now and people are going to get mad at me.
Bob Newhart.
No.
Frank Zappa.
He just died not too long ago. David Berman, right? So David Berman of Purple Mountains and Silver Jews, right? So he died last year or the year before, right? So when he died, like everyone, like in my feed, in my social media universe, or however you want to call it, they all came out of the woodwork and they were talking about how much this band meant to them and you know how much his songwriting had touched them, and they were posting covers and organizing benefit shows and all this kind of stuff. And there's a part of me that had my kind of like old Adam reaction to that, which was like, oh shit, like I am not up to date on David Berman. Like I don't know anything about this guy's discography. But apparently everyone else does. So, you know, here I am, you know, standing around like I've like walked into a party that I shouldn't have, and I don't know anyone that's there. And I had that like, I gotta go catch up on this. I gotta go rush and catch up on this. And I did the thing that I do where I'm like, you know, I'll go and I grab their latest record and I'm listening to this and I'm trying to figure out like, oh shit, like what, why did this mean so much to everyone? I gotta get on there. I gotta figure it out. And that's a horrible way to have to go and engage with something because it's never going to have the resonance that it would have if you were, you know, following it along and not in a mad rush. And I came out the end of that effort and I don't remember any of it because I jumped into it in this like, I imposter syndrome panic to try to figure out what was going on in this guy's discography. And one of the things that's been nice about my like super hyper local focus is that like I don't do that too much these days anymore. And I write it up to my, I write it off as a, you know, oh, but that doesn't fall into my beat right now. So, you know, I'll get to that when I get to that, but it's not likely to happen too much. So, but I totally used to do that, and it always led to like the worst, like the worst impulses as a music writer. I remember like really early on in Punk News, where I'd never listened to like fucking Brand New ever, and right when that band's first probably wasn't their first record. It was their second record. Yeah, the one with, like, there was, like, a... I feel like there was a spaceman on the cover or something like that. But I don't know. Whenever that band had, like their big... their big moment before everything went sour for them, of course. But, like, when all of a sudden that they were the zeitgeist and everyone was talking about Brand New... It was that same sort of thing where I'm like, ah, oh, fuck. I'm like, I don't know who this band is. Everyone's talking about them. And I never felt like, yay, I'm going to go learn about this band everyone loves. It was always like, oh, hell, I have to write a top 20 list of 2006. And I don't know anything about this band that's at the top of everyone else's list. So I'm going to go rush, listen to them and then claim that I'm a well-informed fan and all this stuff. And it's like, it always, every once in a while, I run into something where I've written it back then, and I've clearly written it under those circumstances, or I'm trying to catch up with stuff, and it always comes off as hollow and stupid. So yeah, I'm constantly fighting with that. So my local stuff is partly a crutch that I can use, or an excuse that I can use to not have to know everything about everything.
Fair enough. This is from. I mean, do I feel that pressure? Just because we cover a wide range of music and just because I'm trying to, I mean, I still do freelancing for some websites. I try to stay relatively aware of what's going on. And also, like, I'm I don't want to become, quote, the old man. The old guy that says, man, why don't bands play like The Clash anymore? Where's The Clash? I want to hear The Clash, you know? Like, it's a tough, you don't want to be the, Steve Buscemi with his skateboard and the backwards hat thing. What's up, fellow young people? You know, but you don't want to be like the old guy that says, I want to Clash. Well, where's Clash? You know, so I don't know, man. It's a fine line, and very few people can find that balance. But we'll do it. We'll do it. This is from someone called XH, I guess. This is a question for all of you, but it concerns John. John played a track by Susan Ree. I liked it. I looked up the song on YouTube. As it turns out, the band is called Susan Ree and the Orientals, which John conveniently left out. This isn't an attack so much as a discussion. If a band has an offensive name or offensive lyrics, like the Fairy Tale of New York that you discussed, how much of it should be ignored, how much should be set aside, and maybe it should be forgotten? I think if you just leave it there, it leaves it open for people to continue their racial prejudice under the guise of history or heritage, not hate. And that's from XH, or someone that's named something like that.
Hmm. Now, I think in your defense, I swear that you actually mentioned that.
Maybe I did. I mean, I with Susan, I think it's relevant that she is Korean and she named the band, you know. And I also think it's relevant that in that example is in 1980, the term Oriental wasn't considered as offensive as it is considered now. Like, people would use that term. I mean, you could say it always was offensive, and I might agree with you. But when people would use it, they didn't intend for it to be a hurtful term at that time always. Like, some people just use the... Then some people use the word Oriental, like we might use the word Asian now. So I don't know if that's a great example, honestly. And maybe I did say the full band name. I don't recall, you know. I think with Fair Tale New York, I think I made myself pretty clear. Like I don't think – I think we have to allow – I think we – and we are kind of losing this. Is I think we have to accept that humans are capable of nuance and poetry and art, and that not everything is its most literal level. And so if the intention of the artist, and if it's relatively clear that it's not meant to be hateful, directly hateful, then I think it's okay. That's my position. Like, Mark Twain uses the N-word a lot, but he's not saying, I hate N-people. He's actually arguing that at a time, the conditions of African-Americans was extremely unfair, you know? And so to ignore that or to erase that, I think, defeats the exact message. And I realize the Mark Twain is the standard example for that, but I think it's true with Fair Tale of New York. I think it's true with Susan Ree, particularly because she is Asian and she's been in Marvel movies. And so, yeah, that's my stance.
Yeah. And I do think, you know, there is like a thing where, yes, I think the fact that she's Asian makes it different from if it was like just a band of all, you know, Caucasian people. And there is a time thing, right? Like it was okay to say that in the '80s, and you know, you can't go back in retrospect and change the name of your band on everything you released. you know, because people look unkindly on language you used or things that you said, you know. So I think, yeah, there's sort of like two different filters that you have to put over that, that to me make it maybe not as offensive. And it's so crazy though, right? Because it's a conversation we have so many times, which is like, what do you do when you like art, but then there's something political about the art or the artist that you have decided that you can't or don't like anymore? And I think we're all just like, we're all figuring that out. It's like, it's kind of mind melting sometimes to just to try to figure that out. But I love having the conversation.
I think part of the issue is that we're not culturally on a track right now where we're encouraging people to hold two contradictory ideas in their hands at the same time. Like we're not taking that as a virtue. And I'm trying not to make this sound like it's a thing about cancel culture, just because that's been so hijacked and politicized. But I mean, to a degree it is like you can, I believe that you can, for example, you can listen to the Smiths and also acknowledge that Morrissey is a jackass with a huge number of problematic, you know, things that have come out of his hole. And, you know, you don't need to not, you don't need to completely disengage from the art because of that acknowledgement, in the same way that, you know, that you can, and I think it's easier when you're looking at like something older, because you can gloss over the contradiction by saying, you know, like, oh, well, at the time that, you know, they thought this, or they didn't have the same relevance or something like that, that it does today. But like, I think that it's okay to hold those two things in your hands and acknowledge both of them and just, but and not just disconnect. Like you can totally recognize that like Bodies is a super problematic song, but still listen to the Sex Pistols.
I don't know that it is, though, honestly.
I know. You could read it as a super problematic song, but not...
But
not,
you could read Blitzkrieg Bop as a super problematic song.
Okay. I knew I was going to give you an example you're going to leap on, right? But you know what I mean? Like, you can
yeah,
do both.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
You can acknowledge that, you know what? Yeah, maybe some of the lyrics that are in Fairy Tale, you know, some people are going to have a problem with. But then you could also say that was the song that was created at the time, and like we can hold those two thoughts in our hands, right? Like we don't have to go, oh well, because there's this difficult aspect to it, we gotta jettison the whole thing and like and only pursue only pursue or consume things that are like past the bar of like modern day purity. It's too fraught. But no one wants to say it's a virtue that you can do that, because everything is so reactionary at the moment. So that's, you know, that's the game you have to play. I mean, I think the big part of this is like, listen to what you want, do it with an open mind, just don't talk about it on Twitter, and then you'll be fine.
I have like a weird line that I've drawn for myself, which is like, if I have like a real problem with an artist, something that they've done or said, you know, actually Morrissey is a great example. Like I'm still going to listen to my old Smith CDs. You can't stop me. I'm going to, those songs mean everything to me. And to me, those are my songs now. Those are my memories. I have my own personal attachments to those songs. But where I draw the line is like, I just try not to give that guy my money. Like, I'm not going to go buy a concert ticket. I'm not going to buy a new thing. If he puts out new stuff and I want to check it out, I'm going to figure out a way to check it out for free. And that, I would be so curious though to hear how other people like are handling that. But I've been finding that lately, that's the line I'm drawing. Like, I'll still go back and I'll listen to old stuff that I already spent my money on before I knew this person was like problematic. If I want to, if it still brings me joy, if someone's done something that makes me so upset that their music doesn't give me joy, or their art doesn't give me joy anymore, then obviously I'm just walking away from it. But it's interesting where like I've drawn a financial line in the sand.
Oh, so this just hit us the other day where we're watching. It's like we had never watched, my wife and I had never watched Parks and Rec. And it's on whatever streaming of the 500 streaming services that we subscribe to. So like a week ago or so, we're like, we should watch Parks and Rec. We've never watched Parks. So we start watching it, and like pretty instantly you realize that like you know, like in the first, at least in the parts of it that we're in right now, like Louis C.K. shows up as like a fairly frequent guest star early on in the show, and of course Aziz Ansari is a regular in it. Right now, when Aziz was canceled, it was, you know, it was for less of an infraction than for the things that C.K. has done. But you do have that moment at the where we're like, oh, can we not sit down and watch this thing because there are people that are in it that have since become problematic culturally, like, you know? And it was just like a split second thought, but we're just watching it, and we're not sure what anyone, us in particular, has to gain by, you know, going over this slate of entertainment that is in front of us and saying, you know, well, you know, we gotta write all these things off because of the problems, and just I don't know. It just feels like there's enough shit that we have to deal with in life right now than trying to analyze all of the artists that are behind the piece of art and figure out who we're performatively ignoring them for. So yeah, I wouldn't go. You know, I'm not going to go see Louis C.K. do a stand-up thing right now. I mean, COVID aside, because exactly, I'm not going to go give him my money. But, you know, we're also, I think, going too far if, you know, oh, we can't watch some sitcom from a decade ago because of the problems. Did we get way off this person's question? I feel like we kind of...
I don't know. Anyway, join me at podcast@punknews.org, and we love getting your mail.
We do. Anyone want to play a song before we move on to some of the things?
Sure. I'll play a song. Honestly, last year and this year, I listened to a lot of synth punk, and I'm worried about ODing on synth punk, but it's so good. It's so good. So this is a band that I think other cool people know about, but I know about. It's called Skull Cult, and they actually have a couple of releases out, like four or five. They put out a 7-inch like last year, or two years ago now, I guess. And it's just self-titled, I think. And the last track is a cover of Talking Heads' Psycho Killer, and it's super rad. This is Skull Cult doing Psycho Killer, but you should check out the entire 7-inch.
Better run. of this crap.
All right, that was Skull Cult.
Skull Cult. Synth punk.
All right, so let's talk about some of the stuff that went on this week. Do we have an order for this? Are we just going? Can I pick?
Picker's choice.
Okay, let's talk about the things that I think are really important first. John, our buddies in Fucked Up look like they are working on this year's Zodiac.
But is it a they or is it a he? You see.
All right. Well, hold on. I'll do the story, and then you can throw your speculation out there. So there is of course a series of 12 inches that the Toronto hardcore band Fucked Up has been releasing slowly over the past decade or so, which is their Zodiac series. So they're releasing. Usually there is a sort of single, elaborate extended play. A side and a slightly weirder B side on each of these sets that come out. These are really Fucked Up leaning into their most like uncommercial maximalist tendencies, where they will go and put together a 14-minute song full of strange wailing noises or something like that, and that totally works in this context. So there have been, I don't even know what count we're at right now for how many of the Zodiacs are out, but they are now approaching Year of the Horse, and they keep teasing it. They keep posting, pictures of horses and little bits of that. The last Zodiac release was Year of the Snake, which was done in 2017. So we are we don't have a release date yet. We have no actual written confirmation that this is out anytime soon. But they're all making it sound like it's coming. So, John, what was your angle on this?
Well, I got lots of angles on this. My first angle is it sounds mega rad. And it's honestly like Damon Abraham, the singer, had a band called, what was the name of that band?
Pink Eyes?
No, the Integrity Worship Band. Oh, my God, I can't remember the name of that band. I Start Fires With My Mind. Oh, what was the name of that band? I can't remember. Oh, Millennial Rain. And this, I mean, this 5-second clip, 10-second clip sounds almost exactly like Millennial Rain. It sounds like effed up worshiping Integrity. And I know they're huge fans, or at least several members are or were. And my favorite effed up stuff is almost always Zodiacs. I love Year of the Pig. I love Year of the Dragon. Year of the Snake was great. All the year releases are very good to amazing. Like Year of the Dragon is amazing. Year of the Pig is amazing. This is sounding hot. And honestly, like the way that they're promoting it, it sounds like that they think it's pretty cool too. So I'm excited. It's been a little while since they put out something. People might, I mean, Effed Up used to put out like a new 7-inch like every month or every other month. There was one year they put out like 9 records or something. And so for them to only put out like 1 record every other year for them is, well, not now, but that was a very long gap for them. But I'm extremely excited for this. I wonder what label it's going to be on. I thought that they were only going to do the Zodiacs on a different label every time. But Tank Crimes got it twice, so it could be Tank Crimes, it could be somebody else. But Adam brings up a question. He says, are they promoting it or is he promoting it? There's always this rumor, and it got beaten into the ground, but maybe it's growing legs again, in that Damon Abraham and Mike Halachuk, are they getting along? Are they even working together? Does Damon even want to be in the band? Does Mike even want to be in the band? Because sometimes Mike can be so aloof. But I think he does. I think Mike really does want to be in the band and do the band. I just think he's a unique individual, and I think that he's kind of a weird guy. And I don't mean to talk about him to compliment him because he's made amazing art. I think the vast majority of the music of Effed Up is done by Jonah Falco and Mike Halachuk, as was explained with the last album, Ghost Your Dreams, which Damien, I think, didn't write any lyrics, right? And that was like the big thing about that. And that was an amazing album. But I'm not anti-Damien. I'm very pro-Damien. I'm just saying is how involved is the band? And maybe can the band survive being almost like a correspondence school? That is, from the outside looking in, it appears that Effed Up is really just Mike Halachuk and the drummer, I just said his name, Jonah Falco. And even Jonah's in England, so it's tough for a band to be in two continents, even nevertheless two cities. And so usually that's the death of a band. When somebody moves away, like, that's usually when the band kind of falls apart. You know, it's like, well, I got more important things in my life than the band. That being said, because Effed Up is kind of the many-armed creature that it is, maybe the distance really isn't that big of a deal, and maybe that's what's continuing to let them survive, because they're not getting on each other's nerves, and it is not the main thing in all their life. But the other thing, the other aspect is, well, if it's not the main thing in all their lives, then maybe they don't care as much, and maybe the music can suffer. But then again, the counterattack is, this sounds fantastic, you know, just a 10-second clip out of the 15-20-minute song that it is. A lot of questions, not a lot of answers, and I don't think we're going to get them. But I'm very happy that Effed Up is still around, and I'm super happy that this sounds aggressive, loud, and badass. Some of the Zodiacs were kind of spacier and trippier, which I dug. Year of the Hare, very trippy, not too hard, but I dug it. But then, like, Year of the Dragon, super hard, which I think Year of the Dragon might be my favorite at this point. Hallie Bullet, what's your take?
I'm psyched that they're just still making music together. I was privy to a conversation where with one of the band members, where it just sounded like there were so many bad feelings that I, as a fan, was like, oh, am I never going to hear music by this band again? So I'm just kind of glad to, I'm glad that they're still making stuff. And I'm curious to know I don't think I'll ever get an answer to this, but I would wonder if the pandemic had maybe something to do with it, because in a way, like, everybody's making stuff remotely now. It's kind of the only way anyone can really make music. And so I wonder if there wasn't some piece of that that played into this, where it's like, well, hey, what, you know, we have this Zodiac series. It'd be cool to be able to follow through with it. And, you know, if we're all spread all over the globe and everyone's making stuff remotely anyway, why don't we just, you know, put something out? But yeah, the clip is very short. It was a little too short for me to figure out if it was like something I was going to love or not. But I'm just super, super excited that they are still able to make music together as a band, you know?
I remember when they first started the Zodiac, it was almost like I remember like websites were like, ha ha ha, Effed Up says they're going to do 12 whole records about the Chinese Zodiac, ha ha ha. And now that we're getting kind of close to the end zone, I'm like, oh God, make it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it would be so kind of like tragic if they didn't, you know?
Poor Sue Grafton got all the way to Y and then died. Oh, you know, oh, brutal.
I have way less anxiety than you do about the longevity and future of Fucked Up at this point. I feel that the signals that I'm reading from all of their like various social interactions with each other seems they, you know, to me it seems like as convivial as this band gets between its various members in public, like that all seems, it seems okay right now. It doesn't seem to be worrying me. The distance, I think actually like the pandemic and the distance are actually going to work in their favor more than some bands, because Jonah has been living on a boat in like on a docked houseboat in England for at least like 2 or 3 years at this point. So that's not a new thing for him. He was definitely over there when a lot of the legwork on Dose was being done. He was over there when him and Mike were putting together the Jade Hairpins record. So those, they're used to working at a distance. They're used to working kind of remotely and using the internet to fire things back and forth between them and assemble things that way. In a way that I think a lot of bands now are being forced to do because of all the lockdowns and isolation edicts and all that stuff, whereas Fucked Up, they were kind of operating that way in the first place. And it is probably better for everyone's big, hairy personalities in that band that they're not all stuck in a practice space or a van together. Other bands, they might need that kind of pressure cooker to do something, but, you know, I think everyone is like self-assured and enough of an artist in their own right in this band that they can go do their own thing and then come back together and make a cool Fucked Up song when they need to. So I don't know. I'm okay. I have no worries right now about Fucked Up as a unit or as a social club or anything like that. I think they're okay. I'd love to hear this thing. This feels like this would be a great little record to get into our hands while we're all stuck at home and I have nothing to do. It feels, you know, like what we don't have anything to do. So what would help more than like a 14 minute fucked up song? Like, where are you going to go?
Hallie and Adam and Hallie moving to another continent. Is that a passive aggressive F you when it comes to a band, or is that just the way life is? And sometimes you got to do it.
It's maybe an aggressive thing if you're all 20. But if you're like, getting into your middle to later adulthood years, the fact that you can kind of go and live the life that you want to live and still maintain your artistic relationships seems healthy to me.
Yeah, I couldn't have said that better. Yeah, exactly. Like, they were young and had just started the band and were like super excited to just like get in the van together and tour and be practicing all the time. But yeah, it's like everyone's grown up, so you gotta like live your life. That being said, it's like the band's not, it's, you know, any band is not going to be the same once a member moves away. But it sounds like all the members of this band would be fine with that.
I feel like it was like a big moment for me, like maturing as a music listener from being a teenager, was to come to realize that like bands don't just hang out with each other all day long. Like sometimes they don't see each other sometimes the members of a band won't see each other for 8 months, and that doesn't mean anything. Like especially today, like you'll hear, I feel like bands used to make all these like dramatic statements about like, oh, we're going on hiatus, and it was a big deal. And like as a teenager, like it was like, no, my favorite band is going on hiatus. But then you have other bands that don't say anything. They just, you know, go and live their separate lives for 2 years and then come back together and make a record on like year three. And then you're like, oh, I love that this band is still together and still doing their thing, but like those other jerks went on hiatus. But like, both bands didn't see each other for the exact same amount of time, and it meant nothing. And it's just, it's you when you're a teenager, you always think that like, you know, it's just like the fucking Scooby-Doo gang driving around, and if they're not together, then it's all falling apart. But I don't think that's how
it works. It's the fault of the Clash and AC/DC, because the Clash on the first record, they make it sound like they're all hanging out, going to riots, going to punk shows, and causing trouble. Like, that's what it sounds like on that first Clash record. AC/DC, it sounds like every night they go out drinking and fist fighting and having a good time. It's both of those bands' fault. When it turns out that the Clash pretty much stopped getting along right after their first album, maybe the second, and AC/DC never got along, sadly.
I mean, and we're all living it right now. I was thinking about it the other day, and I'm like, you know what? There's friends that I haven't seen in a year at this point, and I probably won't see them until, you know, I might not see them in person this year at all, the way things are going around here. So like there's certain people I will not have seen physically in 2 years, but in, you know, in 2022, and when we go out and, you know, get a coffee together or something, because we can do that again, it's probably just going to seem like, you know, like it's just the next time that we did it. You know, it's not going to seem like it's been 2 years. So strange times. Anyways, yeah. So that's the fucked up story. That's the one I was most excited about, John. That's the thing that is.
I'm excited. I'm really excited for that record, Adam. Very excited.
So I want to jump from hardcore to ska here. But we're still on long songs, so maybe it's fitting. The Mighty Mighty Bosstones have signed to Hellcat. So it's 1998 again. Everything is super cool, and the Mighty Mighty Bosstones. So they signed to Tim Armstrong's Epitaph imprint, Hellcat Records. They put out a quasi animated lyric video for their first song as part of this arrangement. The song is called "The Final Parade," and it notably features a giant list of third wave ska personalities, and maybe some two-toners involved in it. It's got Tim Armstrong on there. It's got Amy Interrupter doing some prominent vocals on it. You know, Angela Moore from Fishbone, Jake Burns from Stiff Little Fingers, Jay Navarro from the Suicide Machines. You got three folks from Less Than Jake involved. Toby and Rusty from H2O are there. John Feldman from Goldfinger. And just like a whole list, people from Big D and the Kids Tables, Dancehall Crashers, you know, most of the Aquabats are involved, people from Buck 09 and the Toasters and the Pie Tasters, Roddy Radiation from the Specials is there. And that's, I left out half of them. So there is a whole ton of ska, and at least, I mean, in the case of say like, you know, H2O, not ska, but let's say ska scene adjacent individuals that are appearing on this. Most of them are doing group vocals and background shouts and stuff like that. But a few of them have prominent cameos singing alongside Dickie Barrett there. So in any case, there's a big, long ska song from the Bosstones as part of their Hellcat relationship. It's whatever they do for Hellcat is going to follow up a 2018 record called While We're At It. And I have thoughts, John, but I'm curious what your thoughts are.
My thoughts are I'm definitely down for wild ska experimentation. I am digging the recent retro ska explosion, or not retro, recent ska explosion. Like I said, I think the band Catfight is amazing. I think a lot of the other new ska bands are kind of cool. I'm not a huge fan of Third Wave, but I do like Neo Two Tone, if you will. But it made me thinking, you know, effed up took hardcore to a new universe. You know, many bands took punk to a new universe. Can there be a band that takes ska to a new universe? And you could argue that the Specials did that with their third album, except for that's not really a ska record. It's really more of like a post-punk record, or just like almost like an 80s rock record, you know? So I think that they're trying to make it a big party, make it extended. I don't know if this track held my attention for the entire time. And so I almost wonder if they have a good idea, but they should maybe work on it a little bit more and make something really mind-blowing. Like, could Mighty Mighty Bosstones make a mind-blowing weird ska record? And is that what people want, or do people just want, you know, more ska? I did think it was somewhat amusing that Mighty Mighty Bosstones are signing to Hellcat, just because, and I'm sure this wasn't the case, but like, you know, in the 90s, Mighty Mighty Bosstones were way bigger than Hellcat, you know? And I just imagine Dickie Barrett, like, he comes into Tim Armstrong's office, you know, Tim Armstrong's daughter is getting married, and he's like, Mr. Armstrong, I have a favor. I need you to sign my band. And Tim Armstrong's like, did you ever invite me for coffee? Go ahead, Allie, go ahead.
This song is too long, you guys. This song is too long. I mean, they needed to have all these guest vocalists just to make there be anything interesting about it once you've gotten past, like, 2.5 minutes. I mean, Tim Armstrong came in and I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. This is kind of fun. And I like glanced at I was like, but it's kind of funny that he's coming in like 3/4 of the way through the song, which is what I assumed. And then I looked down and it's like, the song is only like 1/4 done. And I was like, how long is this thing? Like, it's like 99 bottles of beer on the wall. You're like, I don't need to hear this. And what's happening? I like, it was kind of like, made me feel like I was going a little insane.
It definitely doesn't do enough to justify the length.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, it's fun to do a thing with all your friends, but I'm with John. Make it a better thing. Make it like justify it being 8 minutes long and having all these people collaborate with you on it. Like, make sure it's a good tune first, you know? Adam, what did you think?
So I was a ska kid before, but I was ska curious before I had firmly decided that I was punk. So, you know, I could have gone either way. Like I could have bought like a pork pie hat and just lived that lifestyle. So these were all bands that I was super into, you know, in the late 90s. And from that standpoint, yeah, there is something about seeing the Bosstones sign with Hellcat that makes me feel very warm and fuzzy. Not that there's any reality that's attached to it, but when I put myself into into my teenage mind, it ticks a lot of boxes for me, because we all loved the Boston's at the time, but we were all also, we were being indoctrinated into this like independent music world. And the fact that like the Boston's were a major label band was always something that we had to chew on, right? We're like, we're supposed to be getting into all this like indie stuff and, getting away from all these like sellout majors. And yet we want to be into the Boston's that are kind of on one of these sellout majors. And that was one of those early contradictions that we had to sort out getting into that era. So to be able to go in and be like, the Boston's are on Hellcat. Yeah. It's like, it all works out, because we would have fantasized about that kind of thing at the time. Like, oh man, wouldn't it be cool? Wouldn't it be cool if, if Less Than Jake wasn't on Capitol, but they were on Fat Records, right? And then, of course, those kinds of things happen later. Now, the messy part of that is that, reality never kind of like bears out your teenage understanding of things. Like, the Boston's have been on indie labels for, years before that. They've been on indie labels in the past, decade or so of their career. And none of that clicked in or mattered to me. I just have like a particular... a particular nostalgia for what Hellcat was in the 90s. And again, it's like, even like what Hellcat is at this point doesn't even mean anything either. Like, that label was dormant for years, and then they kind of brought the imprint back with that Interrupters record. So again, you have, going back to that teenage mindset where like everyone's driving around in a van together, like, Hellcat Records was not just a DBA for the Epitaph Corporation that they pulled out every once in a while when they had something that met it from a brand standpoint. Like, Hellcat Records in my teenage head is Tim and Vic Ruggiero and all these guys, and they're in a clubhouse and they're making cool music together, right? So yeah, '90s Adam is stoked by this grouping of people.
Adam, if I may step in, there might be some kind of media coming out this year or early next year with a little bit of Hellcat relevance. And the cool thing about Hellcat is, like, early Hellcat really was a posse of like 7 or 8 deep. Like, it really was the Clash, the first album.
Well, and that was the impression. I mean, at the very least, that was the branding of it, right? Like, that was what they sold. So the thought of Rancid's cool indie label has rescued the Boston's and brought them into the fold. Like, that's just great. I mean, the reality is that, John, were this a punk song, you in particular would be fucking infuriated at it, because this is the ska equivalent of Whiskey and Friendship, right? Like, this is everything that drives you in particular. I'm signaling you out here. This is everything that drives you nuts about like orgcore punk in a way.
Yeah, except for it's obnoxious sounding. So it's better than orgcore punk,
well,
honestly.
Well, sure. But it's completely sentimental. Like, it is sentimental by design.
True.
Not only is it singing about our friends, but they brought all of our friends into the studio for it, right? Like, it's just a big love fest for the genre and nostalgia for the kind of the heyday of the third wave, when it seemed like ska was ascendant at that point. And I don't want to fault it too much on that angle, because that is what the song is. Like, it's not like, it is intentionally a nostalgic love fest. But on the other hand, Those things only go, like, you can only ride that so far if there's not really any substance to it. And I don't think there's any substance to it. I'll absolutely, I turned this on and it made me happy to hear those voices and to see those people credited. And just to know that the Boston's were working with Hellcat, like, that's cool. I thought that was cool. But it's a long, mushy, nothing of a song. And it's the message of the song is that like weren't things great in 1998. It's like, okay, I guess, but that's not like that's not enough. There's no, there's, you know, you I can't ride on a 7-minute song about the virtues of friendship. It just,
right. It's just, there's, I hear you. I listen. I hear you.
There's nothing there. So again, if this was a 7-minute song by the Menzingers where they were singing about, you know, holding on to your friendships as you get older or something like that, then John would throw it out the window. So it's,
I would.
So, you know, it's just, we have,
how insightful. It's nice to have friends. Wow. Wow.
So now, as a one-off wacky single that everyone recorded during the pandemic from their homes when they were, because they were bored, that we're using to kick off this Hellcat era. Sure. It's fine for that. You know, I hope this is not the centerpiece of their forthcoming record, because that doesn't bode well. But just as a one-off lark during a weird time, then, you know, hey, great. I'm fine with it. And yeah, there we go. There's Boss Tones. I'm gonna keep jumping around here because we're talking about long songs. So here's a long song. Kid Congo Powers. So who's formerly of the Gun Club, of the Bad Seeds, and of the Cramps. He has an EP coming out with his group Kid Congo and the Pink Monkey Birds. The EP is called Swing from the Sean Dealer. And it's out via In the Red Records, the great garage rock label. It's out on February 19th. And you can see a video right now on Dunk News for a song called You Walked In. This song is, do you know how long this song is? It is 15 minutes, 14 minutes long.
Right.
So, John, give people some context. Kid Congo, why should they care, and what'd you think?
Well, people should definitely care about Kid Congo. He's a legendary drummer and a great drummer. I mean, he drummed in the Gun Club. He drummed with the Bad Seeds, and he drummed with the Cramps, and he drummed on some of those bands' best records. After that, he kind of stayed in the punk scene, but now he's kind of more involved in the garage rock scene or the garage punk scene, and that's where the Pink Monkey Birds is. This track is somewhat, I don't want to say uncharacteristic, but it's the next step in his evolution. It kind of harkens back to his cultural roots and is also mostly instrumental and is extended and is more of a, I would say, a instrumental. Well, it focuses on the interaction and slight changes between instruments and sounds, then it would be like, here's a badass riff. So it's very much a ambiance type release, but it is a quote rock record. And that's the importance. And if you've been following Kid Congo, this is very natural in his step. I think what was surprising to some people is it's 15 minutes. It's not 3 minutes. It is a 15 minute long track. And I think it's by far the most massive track he's released yet. Hallie Bullet, did you dig the song, and did you dig Kid Congo strutting around the desert in his cool suit? Which also, well, go ahead. I'll let you take it.
No, which also what?
One of these things that I particularly enjoy from the first wave punkers, Alice Bag, Kid Congo, John Doe, even though I'm not a huge John Doe fan, Penelope Houston. They've been doing this thing where they, like, even Jello, they start dressing. Like, when they hit about 50, they're like, well, listen, people, I'm not trying to be a dick here. But, like, Philadelphia's got some real hole-in-the-wall punk clubs where, like, the older punks go. And I'm not trying to – listen, wear what you want to wear. You know, wear what makes you feel good. But, like, you see, like, these 55-year-old punkers, and they're dressing like they're, like, 19 with, like, the ripped shirt, you know. And it's almost kind of a bummer. It's like the golden era are past, you know. But with the OG first-wave punkers, they're like, you know, I got to – and actually – even Scott Sturgeon of Leftover Crackers kind of doing this in a different way. They're like, you know, I still want to look cool, but if I dress like I did when I was 19, it makes me look like Steve Buscemi with the backwards hat and the skateboard saying, "What's up, young fellows?" You know. So what he's doing is a lot of these first wave punkers, they're dressing like not like their parents dressed, but like their grandparents dressed when their grandparents were young and hip, you know. And so I think it looks rad as hell. But it is interesting to see people that, like, when they were younger, they're like, we're the new culture, the new revolution, reflecting and somewhat saying, you know what, some of the old stuff was bad, but some of the old stuff was bad as hell, you know, and I'm going to dress like a badass dude from Tijuana, you know, from 1930. And he does, and he looks cool as hell, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he's He was always like a punk like style icon, and he is like definitely just continuing that in this video. His look is amazing. I mean, you know, like I really loved this. In that, you know, it's not punk. If you go into it expecting it to be like, you know, like a ripping punk tune, you're gonna be sorely disappointed. But it's like, it's super meditative, just like watching him like walk through the desert in this like dope suit, and then like it gets like real weird at the end. He's like dancing and there's shadows. It's like very meditative. And I like seeing older musicians just kind of like, I don't know, it's like a corny phrase, but just like living their truth, you know, like just do you, man. Like, I love that he's still just like, just doing something that speaks to him. And I was so into this. I was so, so into it. I don't know that I would like put on the song around my house, but as like a thing to just like check out and just be like, oh man, that's what this guy is up to now. Like, good for him. I loved it.
What I don't know is like, how is he not hot as hell? Like, and like you see this with like James Brown on stage. It's like, but like wearing a suit is hot. Like even if you have a summer suit, it's still pretty hot. So how are you out in the freaking desert, like strutting around and looking cool as a cucumber? I don't know how these guys do it. I really don't know. I mean, suits are hot as hell, man. What I wear, I can't wait to get the damn jacket off, the tie, you know?
Also, that's, I think he's a guitarist, right? He was a guitarist, no? Am I wrong about that?
In the Cramps? Maybe I'm wrong. I guess he was. I could have sworn he drummed in the Gun Club. Maybe I'm wrong. Did I totally botch this article?
I don't think
you mentioned his instrument at all in the article. You may have botched what you just said, but no one actually listens to the show.
Hallie is correct. Totally guitar. I thought he was the drummer. I don't know why I thought he was the drummer. Hallie, you're right. He plays guitar.
Yeah, he's a cool dude, man.
Yeah, he is a cool dude.
All right, let's play a song. Hallie, you got something?
Oh, I do. Hold on. But what was it? Hold on, wait. Okay, so occasionally when I'm like farting around on Bandcamp, I'll just go to look and see like what their like new recommended punk releases are. Have you guys ever done this? Because I'm baffled every time. I go through the list. I don't know who any of the bands are. When I listen to stuff, I'm like, either like, I'm not totally positive this is punk, or I'm like, I'm not totally positive that I'm into this. And it always makes me feel like, do I not know, like, do I not know what punk is? Or like, do I not like good punk? Like, I always find it confusing. And but I still do it anyway. I'm always like curious to see like what Bandcamp is recommending in the punk genre. And I actually like discovered something like really cool, like a little while back, and I'm still listening to it. It's stuck with me. So I thought maybe it was worth like playing a track on the podcast. So this is, this is this band. They're called Sweeping Promises from Boston. It's like a three piece. It's definitely post-punk. And some of it's a little angular and drony, but in a way that I am totally liking. I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to pretend to know much more about the band. Like I said, it was just like a Bandcamp discovery. But it's speaking to me. And so this song is called Hunger for a Way Out by Sweeping Promises.
promises. John, which of these next stories are you super interested in talking about? We're probably going to get through them all. We're already an hour into this, but what do you really want to do, John?
I got my eye on two of them. One, L.A. Witch. L.A. Witch just put out a new video. L.A. Witch is kind of L.A. Witch is three women that do garage punk, sometimes with a slight gothic feel or horror punk feel. They're on Suicide Squeeze. They're often associated with the Coat Hangers, and they often tour together. And I like both of those bands very much. I know more about the Coat Hangers. But I definitely dig. I actually got into LA with two Dakota Hangers because they're both mutual fans of each other. They put out a video called Motorcycle Boy, and it's a pretty rad video. The video, I think, is particularly interesting because, A, it kind of salutes like early 60s, mid 60s kind of like James Dean culture kind of thing, but also pokes fun at it. But also just the track is just like a really good atmospheric sort of goth, sort of garage punk track. And I dug it. And I think this band has just the right amount of evil. But they don't play up too much. Like, sometimes a band will play up evil too much and just corny. L.A. Witch just have a slight hint of menace that remains in the background, and they don't put it in the foreground. And I think that's what makes them so effective. Howdy Bullet, L.A. Witch, cool or drool?
I liked this. I thought it was good. It had like a leader of the pack kind of dark twist at the end that I thought was cool. And I think I liked it. I'm trying to think if I had anything else to say about it. I mean, I don't know if I'd like this song as well as I like some of the other songs on the album. But I think this band is rad. Adam, thoughts?
No, I agree. I don't have anything super deep to say about this. People should check it out.
Oh, actually, there's another big story. Well, maybe we'll save the other story to some other. The other story is a bomber story. But, well, I don't know.
Make a call, all right, John.
All right, I'm making the call. Listen. There's a gigantic Sublime tribute that actually just came out last Friday or something. It's called The House That Bradley Built, and it is three pack CDs, like 55 tracks of acoustic Sublime covers. And Buck 09's on it, Jim of Pennywise is on it, Milo of the Descendants is on it, Bad Cop is on it, and that was one of the singles, All You Need. I know Hallie Bullitt previously said she did not like Sublime. I don't think this tribute is going to convince her. What I will say is Bad Cop is cool, and they are talented. But what I think, when bands cover Sublime, that only further highlights how talented Sublime was. Because when you hear bands cover Sublime, you're like, yeah, like where's the magic? You know, where's the snappiness? Where's the cleverness? Where's the nuance? And it's just not there. And when you hear bands cover Sublime, it almost sounds like when people attack Sublime, they're like, they're just white frat bros playing reggae. And when you hear people cover Sublime, it sounds like that, you know, often. And so I don't know. Listen, if people are having fun doing this, that's fine. I don't know if this, I mean, I'm a Sublime maniac. I don't know if this tribute was necessary or even, I just don't, if people want to do it, that's fine. I was not blown away by this. I think Sublime is one of these bands where, like, you can't cover them, because the members, particularly Bradley Nowell, were so talented and so unique and were exploring with music. You can't fake that. Like, if you cover Cab Calloway, if you cover James Brown, if you cover George Clinton, if you cover Jello Biafra, you're not going to have that magic. You're not going to have that pop. And I feel with Brad Nowell, that's kind of there too. So if people are having fun, that's cool. So, you know, cover live, you can get away with pretty much any kind of cover because it's live and people are having fun. In the studio, you really got to knock it out of the park if you're doing something that's like done by someone that's extremely unique, talented, and somewhat eccentric. And that's challenging to do. And so I think a lot of these kinds of things wind up just being things that are fun to listen to once if you're a fan, but they don't live on much after that. And maybe that's okay.
I'm feeling like dog shit, because I said I was going to check out more Sublime and you said you were going to check out more Fleetwood Mac, and you held up your end of the bargain and I did not.
Yeah, well, true. I said I was going to send you five Sublime tracks. That's what I'll do.
So yeah, I don't know. Adam, do you have anything? I have nothing to say about this because I really just, I don't care enough about Sublime to care about covers of Sublime. So I'm at a loss here.
So again, going back to my, you know, two contradictory things you can hold in your hands at the same time. So the two contradictory things here are, on the one hand, I never want to hear any bands covering Sublime. And that has nothing to do with the quality of Sublime. It's just one of those It's one of those things I feel like has been inflicted upon me too many times in my life in unpleasant ways. On the other hand, this is actually all a fundraiser. So Bradley Noel.
No, I feel like
yeah. There is the Noel Family Foundation that was started by Bradley's family. They have a place called Bradley's House that is a I'm not exactly sure about the Bradley's House mission per se. It is the, what is it here? Yeah, it's like, so okay, it's what I thought. It's like a, it's a 6-bed addiction recovery center. So Bradley's House exists. It is a thing that is doing good work. It deserves the money that this comp raises for it, and kudos to them for, you know, doing something cool in Bradley's name. So that's the one hand. The one hand is that. The other hand is I probably don't want to hear Buck09 cover a Sublime song, but you know, hey, if I could just, you know, I'm glad they're going to raise some money for this cause. That's all.
And there you have it.
Yeah.
Sublime. They're great.
Poor Sublime. I feel like what a strange legacy for a band to have where you end up, you know, like inspiring some super cringy, you know, like bad, you know, pothead with an acoustic guitar stuff for years after your band has been around, and that stink just latches onto your legacy.
Yeah, it's like you have a bunch of children, but you hate them all. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you do?
So yeah, what are you gonna do? Anyways, that's the Sublime. John, there was a third story that you were really chewing on. Did you?
All right, well, let's do it. This is more an involved story, but listen, Spotify, the most evilest company in music, continues to be the most evilest company in music. On January 12th, Spotify was issued a patent for a system that allowed, and maybe this is not unique to Spotify, maybe lots of I'm sure Adam will have lots of hot takes on this. But anyway, so Spotify was issued a patent that it's a system by which they can record your voice passively. That is, if you have your phone in your pocket, if you have your phone on your table, it records your voice passively and can determine through how you talk, what are the voices in the room, what's your mood, how old are you, what gender are you, possibly what race you are, how stressed out are you, is anyone else in the room, and other feelings like that, just from how you're talking. A lot of people were pretty creeped out by that. I was creeped out by that, but also it begs the question, well, Spotify is most likely not on the cutting edge of spying technology. So what other companies are out there doing this? And I really do hate, it really is bumming me out how like we are in a surveillance state and like how like you don't even know what kind of information you're giving away and it is being used against you. I sell stuff on eBay once in a while. And just yesterday, eBay was like, we need your social security number. I'm like, I'm not going to give you my social security number, eBay. Get the hell out of here. Like social security number. When I was in like middle school and elementary school, they're like, don't ever give your social security number to anybody. Now you go to like McDonald's, like, we need your social security number to give you a cheeseburger. You know, it's like it's crazy. And the worst part is that you don't even know what's being tracked when. Even like you think, oh, okay, Spotify can only track me when I have it on, when I'm using it. Spotify can track you even when you don't have the app open as long as you have it installed on your phone. So what are the other apps doing? It's creepy as hell, man, and I'm not down with it, and I don't know how we can fight against it. I don't know if it's a lost cause or what, but I am not down with it at all, bro.
Me neither. And like as you're talking, wait, what about Sublime?
The Sublime, if they were around, they could solve all this problem with a heartwarming song, mixing reggae and hip hop and punk to a delightful, catchy song, which actually has substance underneath the catchiness of it all. They could solve it. Go ahead, Hallie.
I mean, as you're saying this, I'm like going into my Spotify settings just to see how I can cut them off from access to my microphone. And it's like, not, you know, I'm not like the most tech savvy, but there's definitely not like an easy way to just be like, hey, Spotify, don't freaking listen to what I'm saying. I think you could turn off the Siri part. Maybe that would do it. But yeah, the whole thing's just fucked. I don't, I hate it. I hate it. All this stuff makes me want to throw my cell phone in the garbage and like be a paranoid person. I can't handle it.
This is, I mean, it's, if this was the, something that came to fruition, it's super gross and creepy and strange. I suspect that this is, I mean, this is a patent that they've applied for, and it's a patent that they applied for 2 years ago. So it's not necessarily indicative of a real product so much as an idea that they decided was unique enough that they wanted to go put their stamp on it. So, you know, they've diagrammed out what they need, how this would work to the degree that they could get the patent application in for it. But on the other hand, I don't know if it actually represents something real. So, you know, Spotify sucks and they're gross, and don't get me wrong, but I don't think that anyone needs to like throw their phone in the river just yet with regards to this.
Thanks, I mean, Adam.
if you really want me to assuage your fears, I could explain to you how exactly Siri listens to you and why it's not necessarily as creepy as you may think. But
I'd love to hear. Can you? Is that?
Oh, don't like, listen to Hallie. Don't listen to Hallie. All my tech friends, they're like, oh, you don't need to worry about, you know, computers like listening to you and keeping track of your social security number, and then people get hacked and their life gets screwed. Don't listen to Satan. Go ahead, Adam.
Okay, no, I mean, I will explain to you. I'm not saying that you should trust these things, because of course they could
not
just,
today, Satan.
Of course they could not do what I'm going to say and do something nefarious. But on a technical level, any of these devices right now that are listening for you to say, and this is always fun to say on a podcast, because you can fuck with the listeners. So if I was like all of a sudden to go like Alexa, right, then half the people that are listening to this show on a public speaker, their house just went bloop. But the way that any of those things work is there's a chip that's in the device. The chip is listening locally on the device on a short loop that's about long enough to kind of catch the wake up keyword. So it may be listening. It's like listening on a constant loop every 2 seconds or however long it takes you to say, hey, Siri or Alexa or computer or whatever you use to talk to your device. Hey, Google or whatever it is on the Google ones. Right. So it's constantly on a little loop, checking against the ambient noise that it hears to catch that keyword. Once it catches the keyword and matches it against the kind of like the stored recording that it has of the keywords, and once it hears you say, you know, hey Google, then it kicks in the secondary speaker that actually is listening, or the secondary mic that actually is listening to what you are going to say, and then parsing that and sending it off to the internet. But without that initial keyword trigger, the secondary mic function doesn't actually kick in on it. So it's not like it's just sitting there constantly listening to you and beaming the things that you're saying in the room out to the internet for whatever nefarious purposes. It's doing something that doesn't involve the internet at all, that is strictly within the chip that's on the device, just to listen for the keyword to click in. And then once the keyword clicks in, then all bets are off and it just starts sending your shit to the internet. But so, you know, so it's not like there is like an open mic sitting in your room that the FBI is using to listening to you. And you just live with that for the convenience of having Siri in your life. It's not. Now that is, again, that's how they say it works. So, you know, I'm entirely willing to be wrong, and like actually Mark Zuckerberg has a secret bug in everyone's house and he's just sending your stuff to the Russians, but that,
you know. So it's not happening now, but they're saying they're going to be able to tell your mood, which is obviously like they can't tell your mood second loop. So this is like, so
that's just it. It's like, there's no way that what they're explaining here in the patent could work unless your device was not operating in this like passive listening for the keyword mode, but that it was listening just all the time. Right. So they've patented that, but that's not how any of these things work. Like, despite the fact that Spotify might want it to work like that, like, your iPhone doesn't do that. Like your Android phone doesn't do that, at least at the moment. So there's got to be some bridge that you have to cross by which it would put it into the realm where Spotify is going to start operating that way. And that either means Spotify introduces some device that does that kind of thing. You know, they release some sort of like little blobby speaker you can put into your home that like, you know, mood musics you, or it's got to be somewhere where you go into, you know, or where you go into the app and put it into that mode. And it just starts listening to the world as it figures out what you want to listen to. I mean, you should imagine you walk into your house, you have a fight with your spouse, you're all mad, and then all of a sudden, like your Siri device or your Siri device, your Spotify device is like sitting in the corner, is like, Hallie, you sound pissed. Here is some smooth jazz, and then it just starts like that's not a world I want to live in.
But at risk of, and you guys can cut this off because I don't want to go on and on about this too long, but like, you know, like, cause John, I feel like your reaction is the same as mine. It's just like, ugh, I don't want you. Like, no, fuck off Spotify.
But that's like, because Adam is a Terminator and he's not even actually a human. He's a robot manufactured by Spotify to convince us that Spotify is not a harmful entity, but it is.
Well, Adam's being a little more rational about it, but then when I do try to see try to sort of talk myself over to the other side, I'm like, well, what does it matter? Really, this being from the woman that just said I was going to throw my phone in the trash, but like, what does it really matter if Spotify knows what mood I'm in? I mean, what? So they're going to try to sell me some stuff, which like I'm not really like particularly. Vulnerable to that. Like I really only buy things I want to buy. Like advertising has absolutely almost no effect on me whatsoever. So like sometimes I'm like, yeah, well, but what if they were listening in on me? It does freak me out. But then when I really think about it, I'm like, what is the, I don't think it's right, but I do sometimes wonder like, what is the real harm if Spotify knows my gender and what mood I'm in? I mean, basically they're just going to try to sell me stuff.
But I disagree.
First
of all, that's all we know, but B, it's not going to stop there. That's just step one of 70. You know what I mean? Like maybe they can influence you, subconsciously, you know, or maybe, I mean, these guys get hacked all the time, you know? So sure, Spotify's just going to try to sell you stuff. Some Russian dude's going to, you know, figure out like, you know, what medication your mom needs. And say, well, I'll block that from you through your health insurance thing, you know, unless you pay me money. You know what I mean? Yeah. I realize that's the worst case scenario, but listen, these things do happen, you know. Not to mention is I'm not cool with Spotify making money off me and selling my information to other people. What are they going to do with it? You know, maybe Spotify is trustworthy, even though they're not. But the guy they sell to and the guy that he sells to, he's not trustworthy. And also, I just don't want people listening to me, man. I want privacy. I don't want to erode the fundamental American concept that you are entitled to privacy and free speech, which is being eroded every day, and it bums me out, and it doesn't seem like anybody cares. That's my stance. Down with Spotify, up with Sublime. Stay with Bradley.
Spotify's ultimate goal is to eliminate the artist. If Spotify could get by without having to deal with all of these pesky questions about like paying artists and artist rights and stuff like that, they would be totally they'd be just happy, right? And I'm not saying Spotify's goal is to like kill the artist in a Terminator standpoint. I mean, if they could listen to your mood and then procedurally generate you some computer created on the spot like EBM music that they have the full rights to, that never interacts with any other rights holder. Oh, that's what they want. I mean, they want to own the content in the same way that, you know, Netflix is producing their own shows right now because they don't want to have to worry about like trying to buy the license to The Office or something, right?
Yeah, but those shows are good. Let me throw another concept at you the two main reasons I got, this is like 4 or 5 years ago, I got a smartphone so I could check my email, but also the directions. You know, like when you're lost, the directions is super helpful on a cell phone, you know. Yeah. But a lot of people don't even print up directions or write out directions. They just use the directions no matter what. I found that if I don't look up the directions myself and I just use the phone, I can't remember how I got there. But if I write out the directions and follow on a piece of paper, then I remember how I did it, and I don't need to look at it the second or third time. But if I just use the phone that tells me where to go, I don't remember how I got there, even if I did it three or four or five times. So to me, that's evidence that even though that – I don't think Google Maps, whatever, is saying we will make people not remember how to get there. I just think that's the unintended side effect, right? And so if Spotify is saying, oh, well, John's happy, we're going to play this music, you know, maybe that will affect me in ways that I don't want to be affected when I don't even realize I'm being affected, you see.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Adam. And also Adam is saying Spotify kind of killed my joke, but I'm going to say it anyways. Once Spotify realizes it can kill the artists, get rid of the artists, it might realize that it can get rid of humanity. And what do we have? Terminator 2 again. Mm-hmm.
There you go. So anyways, this has been the Punk Juice Podcast. It's been like a million hours, so I think it's bedtime.
At least we're not talking about like Bitcoin conspiracy. We're just talking about Spotify conspiracy. You know, you know who really controls the global market, Adam? Lizard Men. Lizard Men in the center of the...
Whatever happened to Lizard Men? Like, it was all so much easier when all the kooks just believed that like lizards were creating controlling the world, and they didn't have to bring like fucking racism into it. Like, we weren't racist against the lizards. Fucking lizards.
Bring back the lizards.